The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu. Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. You can go beyond giving to impact. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
Sunny skies at the moment. Welcome to this Wednesday edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Coming up in just a moment, a California woman, Lily Trujillo, shares the story of her 16-year-old daughter, Valentina, who was killed in a street racing accident, and how all this led to starting her own organization.
First thing I thought when I was underneath that parking lot was that I didn't know what I was going to do, but I was going to do anything I could to prevent a parent from losing a child, to prevent this horrible pain.
That conversation coming up in just a moment. In other news, okay, trick-or-treaters, don't get too sad. Halloween may not be a total bust. However, the CDC is issuing some guidance to celebrate Halloween and even Thanksgiving. Now, the agency says activities such as trick-or-treating or attending parties can be, quote, high risk. Now, in a statement issued this week, the organization said not to use costume masks in place of cloth mask. For Thanksgiving, the CDC recommends avoiding, if there are any, parades, crowded parties, or road races. And for those Black Friday shoppers, the agency says it's best to sit this one out. In related news, Georgia remains 14th in the nation for new coronavirus infections in the week leading up to September 20th. That's according to the latest White House Coronavirus Task Force report obtained by WABE News. Now, the number of counties in the, quote, red zone for high levels of COVID-19 transmission also remains stable. 47 met that threshold. Now, the White House says state leaders should expand testing capacity as fall approaches and limit all gatherings to 25 people or fewer. And at this time, there's been 308,221 COVID-19 cases confirmed since March right here in the state. 27,490 have been hospitalized, and of those, 5,026 were ICU admissions. And 6,677 Georgians have reportedly died due to the coronavirus. And the top five counties with the number of confirmed cases, well, they are as follows: Fulton, Gwinnett, Cobb, DeKalb, and Hall counties. 18 to 29-year-olds remain the age group with the highest rate of hospitalizations. As always, this is according to the State Department of Public Health. And finally, those numbers are the reason why the Atlanta Falcons and Atlanta United officials say both teams will start inviting some fans back to watch the games in person, but that won't start till October. Team officials, along with the stadium officials, say they made the decision based on declining COVID-19 cases statewide. So here's how it will work before all y'all start trying to get tickets. They will be sold at a limited capacity starting with the Falcons home game versus the Panthers on October 11th. And to test the stadium's operations, the Falcons will host about 500 fans for this Sunday's game against the Chicago Bears. Team officials say they will collaborate with national and local health officials. However, they did say they may stop selling tickets if Georgia's coronavirus cases spike again. This is Closer Look. Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE. This is Atlanta's Choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. Democratic members of Georgia's congressional delegation, well, they're asking the Georgia Bureau of Investigation to probe into allegations of unauthorized medical procedures and medical neglect at the Irwin Detention Center located in Ocilla, Georgia. Now, Representative Sanford Bishop, Hank Johnson, Lucy McBath, and David Scott, no relation, are the latest to request an investigation after a whistleblower complaint was filed by Don Wooten, a nurse working in the detention center. Now, Wooten alleges unauthorized surgeries, such as hysterectomies, were performed on immigrant women detained at the center. And the doctor at the center of the investigation is Dr. Mahandra Amin. Now, we'll read a statement from Dr. Amin's attorney, Scott Grubman, in just a moment. But first, joining me now is attorney Alexis Ruiz, founder and managing partner at Zambrano & Ruiz, who's also representing two women currently detained at Elwood. Counsel Ruiz, thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Rose.
Let's begin here. So you're representing two women who are currently detained. Are you also representing any women who were previously detained at the Irwin Detention Center?
Yes. I still represent Milady Cardente. She was released on Monday from custody at Irwin, and she is back home now in Virginia.
Are any of your clients alleging any medical procedures were performed without their consent?
So Milady did actually have a procedure done at the clinic by Dr. Amin Mahendra, and she was unclear as to what exactly had been done. When I went to visit her last Wednesday at the Irwin County Detention Center, she unbuttoned her jumpsuit and lifted her shirt and showed me a couple scars that she had below her abdomen, which were small and purplish colored. So she had actually requested her medical records, she tells me, about 15 times, and she had not received them until Monday when we went to the doctor's office in person and requested them then.
Counselor, what have your clients told you about the doctor in terms of his manner?
So the one detail that Milady does focus on is the fact that there was a lack of communication. She never seemed to get enough information when she went to the physician's office. She did say there was an interpreter there. However, she still wasn't clear as to what exactly was done with her by the time she left, and even for weeks after that.
Was a language barrier with the doctor?
Yes. My client speaks Spanish. Dr. Mahendra, from what I understand, does not speak Spanish.
What can you reveal? What can you share about the procedure your client had or thought she was having?
So when intake is conducted at the Irwin County Detention Center, the women are asked when they got their period last. And Milady's period was delayed. And she said that as a result, the nurse at the center recommended that she go and get checked. So she did go, and she had a couple consultations before she went in for the procedure on August 14th, and she was told that she had ovarian cysts. After she returned, after she had the procedure done on the 14th of August, Milady returned on the 26th of August. And from what she tells me is the doctor informed her that via the interpreter that she had some sort of cancer growth in a fallopian tube, and that they were able to find that based on a biopsy that they had done on the 14th. She didn't receive any clarity as to whether or not she still had that growth. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it was just that there was a lot of confusion. She was very confused. She was requesting her medical records while she was in detention from the detention center. And, I mean, she was worried, obviously.
Has she had a follow-up? Do we know if they did remove the cysts and if they removed anything else?
From the medical records that we were able to obtain this week, it does seem that the cysts were removed. There were many pages of records, and we needed to leave Osceola very quickly because I needed to take Milady to the airport that same day. However, she hasn't had a checkup since then because it's only been a couple days and she just returned home. However, she does plan to get a follow-up.
But to be clear, she now has, you all have those medical records. From Milady.
We do have the medical records, yes.
But for your other clients, they are seeking medical records?
One of them is seeking medical records. She did get a couple pages that she requested on her own, and my my third client, she hasn't had any medical conducted while detained. She's not seeking her medical records.
Have you had a chance to speak to Dr. Amin?
I have not. As an immigration attorney, my focus is on the immigration aspect of my client's case. And I haven't made an attempt to speak to Dr. Amin.
Now, we received a statement from Scott Grubman, who is Dr. Amin's attorney, and he writes, quote, "We are aware of the whistleblower's allegations as they relate to Dr. Amin and vehemently deny them. Dr. Amin is a highly respected physician who has dedicated his adult life to treating a high-risk, underserved population in rural Georgia," close quote. Your response to that, attorney?
As an immigration attorney who represents detainees in the Irwin County Detention Center, I can say that there is a lot of miscommunication or lack of interpretation between officers in the Irwin County Detention Center and the detainees. The allegations against Dr. Amin, I have no personal knowledge on the statement that was given by his attorney. Mm-hmm. However, I do know that from what I've heard from many, many people who have been detained at Irwin, they make many requests for their records, and they make many requests to see the nurse or to be taken off campus to be checked. And it takes a long time for their records or for their requests to be responded to. So I do know that there is an opportunity there to better the system that they have in place to communicate between the physicians and the deportation officers and the officers who work for LaSalle Correction Center and the detainees.
And Attorney Ruiz, you have been to the detention center? You've been to Irwin?
Yes, I go relatively frequently.
Describe the environment there, the interactions with the staff. What do you see?
When I was there last, I was standing by my car and I was writing down the names of the detainees that I was going to see and their alien registration numbers. And the security officer did circle several times until she finally stopped and asked me what I was doing. And I said, "Well, I'm here to see my clients." And she's like, "Oh, are you an attorney?" And then I said, "Yes." She just continued to circle around. And when I walked into the detention center, the security officer was speaking to the front desk person, I believe informing them that somebody had arrived. And when I walked in, the officers, they asked for my name and they asked for which detainees I'm going to be seeing. They check your temperature. Mm-hmm. And then we're taken into the attorney visitation room. And the door locks behind you when you walk in, and you have to press a button to be let out. So I do wish there was a different way of doing that. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be locked into a room. Mm-hmm. However, the officers then bring in your client, and then you press the button whenever you're ready to see your next client. So you can either stay in the visitation room or you can walk back out by the front desk and wait until your next client is brought in.
And what have your clients told you about the conditions there? Have they revealed that to you?
Yeah, so frequently my clients tell me that they don't believe that they're receiving sufficient nutrition in the food that they're provided at the detention center, that they aren't provided with sufficient cleaning supplies, which they're particularly concerned about now with the current crisis. Mm-hmm. I have been told that they're afraid to speak up because they're afraid of being retaliated against. And they have told me that the officers treat the Spanish speakers differently from the English speakers, being that the English speakers are favored. So they feel discriminated against within the detention center.
When you say for the fear of retaliation, could that be physical or just through some other action?
So the detainees, they've specifically told me that the way that some of their concerns are addressed are by the detainee being whoever is making the claim. Mm-hmm. They're separated. There are different cells, C1, C2, which have the capacity to hold many women. But then there, I believe what they've described to me are little trailers that are still on campus, but just separated from the building itself. And Milady specifically was in one of those trailers with two other women. And Milady asked why she had been separated, and she never received a response. And the other women from the other women detained at Irwin who were in C1 or where Milady was before she was separated, they told me that they also made requests for Milady to be taken back with the rest of them. Milady tells me that she many times spoke up for women and defended them. And therefore she was held in very high regard by the other detainees. They saw her sort of as a leader. Mm-hmm. And she was separated, and Milady believes it was because she was very outspoken.
And again, for clarity, Attorney Ruiz, as far as you know, especially as it relates to Milady, she has not know if she suffered any short or long-term complications, physical especially, based on this procedure, because she hasn't had a follow-up exam.
That is correct. She does tell me that she still feels pain when she moves different ways, when she sits. However, I don't know for certain whether she has any long-term complications. I mean, God willing, she doesn't. Mm-hmm. But she would need to do a follow-up consultation.
And your other clients, what's next? You're still seeking some medical records.
Yes, for one of them, she declined to she it was she was advised by the doctor to also have a procedure done, a gynecological procedure done. However, she declined to have it done. I do believe that it's some sort of cyst abnormality is what was spotted, because that is what she explained. However, I can't say for certain because I don't know exactly what was said.
How long have they been detained?
The second one has been detained since she received an order of removal from an immigration judge. It has been over 180 days. She was born in the USSR, so she doesn't have documents for her return. The USSR no longer exists. Mm-hmm. So I believe ICE is trying to either send her to Ukraine or to Russia. That's up in the air. And then for my first client, she has been detained since, I want to say, February.
And Milady, is she still awaiting some type of immigration hearing?
So Milady actually received an order of removal. She was admitted as a lawful permanent resident in 2016. Therefore, she didn't have any relief available except asylum, but she doesn't have a fear of Cuba. She didn't of returning to Cuba. She didn't suffer persecution prior to coming to the United States. Mm-hmm. So she did take an order, and based on her medical complications, I requested for her to be released, and that was approved on Friday of last week.
She has an order for removal. Would that also somehow delay that the date that she needs to leave?
So Milady will be reporting to the local ICE enforcement and removal office in Virginia, and they are in the process of securing documents for her to return to her native country of Cuba. And it is likely that the pandemic will delay that process. Mm-hmm. Because there's a lot of closures and consulates and embassies, and the acquisition of documents is taking much longer than usual. And she can't be detained. She's particularly susceptible to COVID. Therefore, yes, for now, I can only see her removal being delayed.
What's the percentage of asylum cases? What's the percentage of your clients that actually win an asylum case?
So there's this wonderful database that Syracuse has created called TRAC. And they are able to, or they track all the asylum decisions all over the country, and it's really a wonderful tool. So based on what the data that TRAC has provided, if you are fighting a case for asylum here in Georgia, which includes the Atlanta Immigration Court and the Stewart Immigration Court in Lumpkin, you have approximately 2% or less chance of winning your asylum case. I know it's ridiculous.
2%. And on usually on what grounds?
Yes. So there are five grounds under which you could seek asylum. If you've suffered persecution based on your race, nationality, religion, political opinion, or for being part of a particular social group, which must have immutable characteristics. And you need to be able to show that nexus that you suffered persecution on account mm-hmm. of one of those grounds. Being able to corroborate your claim with sufficient evidence is a huge challenge for people seeking asylum in the United States. Getting the documents from the government, many people have made reports, police reports, but they're unable to get them because the police many times is part, obviously, of the corruption in their home countries. And many people, for example, from Venezuela or Nicaragua, their infrastructures, the bureaucracy back home is highly inefficient, very disorganized. Plus, many people don't have the resources to be able to go and obtain the documents that they need. So it's a huge challenge as immigration attorneys to be able to present these cases in the way that they deserve to be presented on account of inability to be able mm-hmm. to get all of the evidence that we should be able to present to an immigration judge.
And for Milady, was she seeking asylum based on one of those grounds?
No, Milady was not seeking asylum. She was admitted as a lawful permanent resident in 2016 while she was still in Cuba. So she was an LPR prior to her current mm-hmm. proceedings.
But your other clients, they're seeking asylum?
One of them is seeking asylum. That is correct.
If not for these allegations from Don Wooten, the nurse, now there are calls for an investigation. How optimistic are you that for your client's sake and others who are making these allegations that things will change, or would you like to see that detention center closed? For a long time, people have been calling for the closure of that detention center.
I would absolutely like for that detention center to be closed. That would be a dream come true. I think that it's very courageous of the women who have decided to speak up and say something. I think they're a very vulnerable population. They don't speak English. They're 3 hours away from Atlanta in Ocilla, Georgia. They're under the care of individuals who don't speak their native language. It's a very intimidating situation. It's very confusing for a lot of the women. And I just commend them, and I'm proud of them for communicating and for being willing to speak up. And it's really been wonderful that the media has been covering this issue, which as immigration attorneys, we deal with so much, but it feels nice that people are finally paying attention.
Attorney Ruiz, I'm curious, what's your caseload like?
My caseload, I have at least 150 cases, probably.
You alone?
Yes. However, they're not all removal defense. Mm-hmm. Some of them are naturalization or green cards, visa extensions, things mm-hmm. that are affirmative versus defensive.
And then finally, to your knowledge, they have to, by signature, give their consent for any medical procedure. To your knowledge, is that correct?
As far as I know, that is correct.
Even if they're not sure what happened afterwards, but they have given their consent. How concerning is that for you? Because they may have given their consent for one procedure, but then something else occurred.
I am concerned about that because they aren't necessarily being interpreted everything that they're given to sign. I mean, I'm sure it's like quick. You know, it's like, oh, this is what this is. Here, sign it. I don't know if they fully understand what they're signing. Also, there is a power play there. If somebody whose custody you're under is telling you to sign something, regardless of whether you understand it or not, most people are going to sign it, especially women who have just arrived from other countries, who have suffered a lot, who have traveled for a long time, who are all of a sudden in the custody of the government and a private corporation. I mean, there's a lot of pressure there to do whatever you're told to do.
Attorney Alexis Ruiz, founder and managing partner at Zambrano and Ruiz. She's representing women who have been and are currently detained at the Irwin Detention Center in Ocala, Georgia. Attorney Ruiz, thank you so much for taking time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Rose.
Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. If you love Atlanta, you can invest in the big picture. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE. This is Atlanta's Choice for NPR. As always, I'm Rose Scott. Parking lots, public streets, and highways are becoming the locations for large gatherings known as car takeovers or sideshows. There are drivers doing donuts. And then add this, street racing. It's all a problem. You may recall last week on the program, Atlanta City Council President Felicia Moore talked about the challenges in combating this illegal activity.
The police department, I think, is evolving as the situation gets more and more out of hand, and they monitor social media as well. And I believe they know that the police are monitoring them. And so they're finding codes, as you say, or other ways to communicate with each other so that the police department doesn't know where they're going. And one thing people may not realize is, you know, everybody complains about, oh, it's in my neighborhood or they're on my street. But the reality is they're in many neighborhoods and on many streets at the same time, which makes it very difficult for the police. We do have some dedicated crews that are doing it, but if they're blocking intersections or speeding through a particular time, part of town, and there are four different groups, and it's not just in Buckhead, in Midtown, it's all over the city. Mm-hmm. They're in four quadrants of the city. It makes it very difficult to have enough police presence to be able to deal with it. You may have two or three police cars and you have hundreds of street racers.
Now, street racing in the state of Georgia is a misdemeanor offense, and offenders can be fined up to $1,000, face some jail time up to at least a year, and they can also have their license suspended. Street racing is not just a problem in the Atlanta area, it's coast to coast. Now, according to a Los Angeles Times report, 179 people have died in what they call speed contests in L.A. County alone between 2000 and 2017. And my next guest knows firsthand the tragedy that can occur when this happens. Joining me now is Lily Trujillo. She's a founder and executive director of the California-based nonprofit Street Racing Kills. Lily, thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
No, thank you so much for having me today. I really appreciate it as well.
And I understand you're in California, so we really appreciate you taking the time. We're waking up a little bit extra earlier to share your story with our listeners. And that's where I want to start. Tell me about your daughter, Valentina.
Valentina was an amazing soul. Of course, my daughter. Unfortunately, she, you know, passed away in December 7, 2013, due to a street racing crash. Mm-hmm. She was just a high school student, you know. At the time, I was a single mom, and all I cared about was just, you know, coming home and feeding my two children and working, and that was it, you know, taking care of business every day, making sure they had a roof over their head. I had no idea what street racing was at the time, but she was 16 years old when she passed away.
December 6, 2013, I know it's a day that you have talked about so many times. It's a day that changed your family's life forever. Can you take us back to that day, Lily?
Yes, of course. It was just like any other day. Many times she would have sleepovers, and at this particular time, she says, I'm going to go spend it at my best friend's house. Can you take us? But before, can you leave us at another friend's house? Because we're going to be, you know, playing makeup, doing some cooking, and then from there, we'll go over there. And I dropped her off. And when I dropped her off, and I saw her standing there in front of the door, waiting for the other girl to open the door. And she had a little unicorn backpack, and she looked so, so beautiful. Mm-hmm. I don't know why, but I got teary-eyed when I saw her. And I just thought, she has such a beautiful life. You know, I'm originally from Mexico City, so I didn't grow up here. So it's different over there. Mm-hmm. And here I'm like her Uber driver, right? Taking her here, taking her there, picking her up at the beach with her friends. And she's a typical teenager. Little did I know when I got teary-eyed that that was the last time I was ever going to see her alive. So I dropped her off and I went home, you know, waiting like always for her just to text me when she would, you know, get to her other girlfriend's house, and I fell asleep. I didn't know that they got invited to a kickback party. That's what teenagers call it now. Mm-hmm. And the girl with the house where they went, and they said, okay, let's go to these parties in the same city. So then from there, we can go to the house where I'm going to spend the night. As I said before, I was just, you know, just, I fell asleep. So I wasn't aware of what was going on. So at the party, unfortunately, there was alcohol. There was a bunch of, you know, older, you know, kids there. Some college students as well. Mm-hmm. Here you have three girls that as soon as they go in, they give them a drink. The kid that took him there, he was 17. He was shy of 18 a week. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, you know, I have no idea what's going on. I get a phone call. And it's just telling me, hurry up. Valentina was in a crash. I don't know where. And I just hear this kid screaming like crazy, very upset. So what I do is I get my son. He was 22 at the time. And we take off wherever they told us to go. When we get there, there's nothing but yellow tape. And I didn't know that when there's yellow tape, it's because there's been a fatality. They just told us to go to one of the hospitals. I go to the hospitals. I'm walking, running. I'm looking from one place to another. In the emergency room, trying to see what's going on. So I see her best friend, and she's crying with her mom. And I'm like, where's Valentina? Because I'm trying to find her. I think she's in another room. And crying like crazy, she just tells me, Valentina died. I collapse to the floor. My son picks me up. I don't want to believe that she's dead. I have no idea what's going on. They tell me to go to the house because the police is waiting for me there, because they have to talk to me. And I'm hoping, thinking, that it's because she's probably in another hospital. When I get there, they, of course, confirm that she had passed away. And all I remember is my son nodding his head while he's identifying his sister on the cell phone. So the last image my son has of his little sister is her dead. I lost it. I don't remember much, the funeral or nothing like that. My son basically had to man up and take care of everything and call the family. So it was later, maybe weeks, a month later, that I finally started reading the report and see what happened. And what happened was that on the way to her girlfriend's house, this boy decided to, the boy that took him there, he is the one that was taking them there, the three of them. Mm-hmm. And on the way there, he got challenged to a street race by an ex-coworker. Valentina was in the back seat sleeping, her girlfriend right next to her, and the other girlfriend was in the front. As he decided to street race, he was going over 100. This is at 1 o'clock in the morning. He thought he was going to make the yellow light, but he didn't. It turned red, and he hit an SUV and then a fence. It was a really, really bad crash, and Valentina was partially ejected from the window, and passed away from her head injuries. Well, that's what the coroner ended up telling me. And I thought to myself, what did it? What did I do as I'm sitting underneath a parking lot building, thinking while reading the report again? I said, what did I do wrong? What did she do wrong? Shouldn't she have gone to that party? Shouldn't have let her spend the night? Was she being bad? Was she being rebellious? Was she? And I said, no. And then I tried narrowing up. Was it this? Was it that? And I thought to myself, had not he been street racing, she would still be alive if he didn't take that challenge.
Were there any charges filed against this young man or the other driver, Lily?
The other driver ran away. Like it happens, it's very common with street racing. Usually that's why street racing is so hard, you know, to figure out sometimes. And they can say possible street race. The driver most of the time gets away. Yes, he escaped. And there was nothing done that I know of to find the other driver. But this particular driver, the one that was the boy that was taking them home, he was charged, but he was charged as a minor. He wasn't charged as an adult, even though a week later he turned 18. So he went to juvenile court.
Was Valentina the only one killed that night?
Yes, she was the only one.
I understand, Lily, that shortly after Valentina's death, you had a conversation with your son, Luca. What was that conversation about? What did he tell you?
Well, I was, this was through, you know, when everything was happening, and I was just out of it. I was in my bed for days while all of this was happening. And I remember just being there, and all of a sudden he comes and, you know, gets in bed with me and holds my hand and tells me, Mom, I just want you to know something. I want you to know that you still have me to live for, and that I want you to be a grandma and take care of my babies, and you still have me. And I just looked at him, and we're both just crying, and look, just tears are coming out of our eyes. It's not like we're crying. And I looked at him and I squeezed his hand. I told him, I'm not going anywhere. I'm here. I'm here with you. And we both, I think, all I remember, I think I went back to sleep. I don't know. He's my reason for living. Mm-hmm. My son is definitely my reason for living and being in this world still. But I knew when all of this happened, the pain of losing a child is no pain like no other. And I'm pretty sure a lot of other parents out there that have lost a child, no matter what, it's a completely different pain. It's every part of my body was throbbing, the hair, my nails, everything. It's just, you just cannot see your child from one day to another disappear.
Lily, you said you weren't even aware that the street racing, that the kids were even doing that. When you found this out, did you talk to other parents? Did you talk to other kids? Did they say, oh, yeah, this is something that we do all the time?
Oh, well, at the time, yeah. I didn't even know what it was, you know. All of a sudden, I started seeing it more. I think it's when it happens to you is when you start finding out. I started finding out what a problem it was. Like I said, I had no idea. I started seeing it in the news. Before, I don't think I ever read about it or nothing. I started hearing it more. I would see it all the time everywhere, different kinds, you know. I learned a lot about it. I learned about speed competitions, takeovers. I mean, underground street racing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I realized that there was so much of it and how common it is, especially among the youth. Especially among the youth, it's very, very, very common. And young people are fearless. Mm-hmm. And that's when I realized that I had to do something about it. I didn't know what I was going to do.
Well, let's talk about that. You said you had to do something about it. So You're the founder and now executive director of Street Racing Kills. When did you make that decision that you were going to start an organization to bring awareness about this?
The first thing I thought when I was underneath that parking lot was that I didn't know what I was going to do, but I was going to do anything I could to prevent a parent from losing a child, to prevent this horrible pain. I got invited within months to speak at one of her, the schools where Valentina's friends were. Mm-hmm. And they just told me, would you like to come? And I'm like, okay. And I went there and I walk in and I see all these, you know, high school students running around. That would have been, you know, my daughter. And all I had with me was a poster of my daughter, my dead daughter. And it was pretty hard, but I went inside the assembly and they put the poster up and I spoke for the first time. And I saw the reaction on the students. I saw boys tear up. I saw people raising their hand, asking questions. And it was the first time that I smiled when I left. I had a beautiful feeling. I felt her with me. And I knew we could make a difference. That day is the day that I decided that I was gonna found the organization.
And now when you speak to students, but it's just more than speaking. You show vehicles in the aftermath of these street races. What's their reaction?
Oh my gosh, I love it. It's they can see when they see the crashed car, what it does. They see the consequences of it. We show videos, we do reenactments, especially the hospital scene is one of the best that sometimes the drama club does it or the kids do it themselves when we're doing the assembly. They see videos, the crashes that we're being police officers that actually explain to them, this is what happens when you're speeding. This is what the vehicle can look like after.
Here in Georgia, as I mentioned, coming into this segment, street racing is a misdemeanor. In California, what's the law in California? And especially if someone dies?
It depends if you are a minor or if you're an adult. So for manslaughter, like it happened in Valentina's case, the most they can give them is a year plus community service.
That's if they're a minor.
If they're a minor, and they usually get out earlier with good behavior. And we are fighting for that to change. We've had recently a crash where two teenagers were racing and they did nothing. And that was different, I guess, even though the law is the law. It all depends what kind of an attorney you have. These kids were only required to write a letter to the family. They didn't do any time. So it varies, even though the law is law. It definitely varies, and depending the attorney that you have, the district attorney makes a decision at the end. These are things that I learned with time. At the time, I didn't know anything. So one of the things that we do at Street Racing Kill is also we mentor and we help victims of crashes, because at the time of the crash, and when you lose someone, you don't know what the heck happened and how the system works. But and there is bigger charges for manslaughter. Could be 4 or 5 years, even more for adults.
Lily, have you had a conversation with the young man that was driving that night Valentina was killed?
Yes, I did. At the beginning, I wanted to know who he was because I didn't know him. And I asked to meet him. I didn't get much support from the parents, but I was able to just meet him. And when I saw him, I saw this teenager, was by then 18, scared. And he came and told me, I don't know what to tell you. And we just both cried. And he, all of a sudden, I became like his mother. And he starts telling me, it's not fair. I didn't get to have anything of hers. I didn't get to go to her funeral, and I wanted to. And I see everybody with something of hers, a bracelet, a necklace. I don't have any. I didn't get to have anything. And now I have all these charges that I am going to accept. I have to, you know, accept everything. And I don't know if they're going to kill me there. So he was very, very, very scared. Mm-hmm. We hugged. We cried. And he told me, this is the first time I ever feel a little bit of peace. Thank you. And that was it. I went on, you know, doing what I was doing. And all of a sudden, I found out that in 7 months, he's out on good behavior. I didn't say anything. I was upset because I had no right for anything. And I already had the organization. And it was not about revenge or anything. It was about consequences. How can I tell these other kids at a high school that he got out in 7 months? When they, because they do ask me many times, what happened to him? How long was he in there? And I really don't like telling them that he got out 7 months because I want them to know there's consequences. And this is very, very hard. That's why we're fighting for more stricter laws here as well.
And Lily, how big of a problem is this in Los Angeles County? And do you feel like authorities, and even with efforts through your organization and other organizations, are you all making any progress in not only just educating the young folks, because there are adults that do this too, but do you feel like there is some progress being made to combat this activity?
It depends on the county here, and some we are a little bit and some we're not. There's honestly out of control here in Los Angeles as well. We have street racing task forces in different counties in LA. I have partnered with them as well since we met. I take care of the education part as much as I can, and when I first started in 2016 and being more of an advocate and doing more, the street racing task force had already started since 2015, and that was the first one in LA. Now we have, even in San Francisco, there's one. So these street racing task forces really, really, they have a whole room, because I've been there, where there's actually several monitors, and they are on Twitter, they're on Instagram, and they're on Facebook. They're everywhere checking everything to see what they're doing. So when there's a takeover, and as you understand, a takeover is when they take over a street, so they can do either sideshows or racing or donuts or whatever they're going to be doing. What we have done here, I don't know if they're doing it in Atlanta, is they go there right there. They catch them. They let them set up. They already know they're going to be there. And then they start doing their arrest and taking everybody. Even if you're an spectator, you can still get fined and arrested as an spectator. So they just scatter like crazy and they'll go someplace else. So it's like a cat and mouse game. If they catch them right there, they already know where they're going next. So it is a big problem here, but the street racing task force are really cracking down on it, but still it's a big problem, especially with street competitions, because sometimes those are just spontaneous. That's not something prepared. That there's nothing they can do about it.
There are plans to expand your organization to North Carolina and beyond.
Oh, definitely, because it's a problem everywhere. It is a worldwide problem. We have a map at the office where we put everything. And then, of course, Atlanta's there. Texas is there. New York. I mean, you name it. Ohio. I mean, places that you wouldn't even imagine. And yes, North Carolina, we already have someone that is our outreach coordinator over there. And we have plans of going to Pennsylvania next year to speak to an awareness program over there. And we're going to go to Texas as well. So we go anywhere they need us. And if they want us to have street racing kiosks in Atlanta, if you will have us, we'll be happy to go there and provide education to the youth, because we believe that you have to start from scratch and educating the youth of the consequences of street racing.
Lily, you have a motto for your organization, and I'd like in our conversation with you sharing that with our listeners. It's about life.
Live for Val. I ask everyone to live what she couldn't live, and not just her. Every victim of street racing didn't get to live. And I'm talking about adults as well. They didn't get to finish their plans in this life. So I ask everyone to please live what they couldn't live in this world.
Well said. Lily Trujillo, founder and executive director of the California-based nonprofit Street Racing Kills. This is part of our ongoing conversations as it relates to what Atlanta and other areas are trying to do to combat the activity. Lily, thank you so much for sharing your story. Our condolences on the passing of your daughter. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
That's it for this edition of Closer Look, which is produced by Grace Walker and LaShawn Hudson. Our engineer is Shelley Canavy. If you missed any of today's program, it's online at wabe.org/closerlook. And of course, you can listen to Closer Look weeknights at 8 p.m. and listen whenever you want, because Closer Look is now available as a podcast. Just visit NPR One or your favorite streaming app and subscribe. This is 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now Plugged In, a WABE politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WABE politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WABE.org or your favorite podcast platform.